Welcome to Women in Translation, a series showcasing the richness of European women authors, translators, and more.
In this episode, host Kate Williams speaks with German author, poet, and sound artist Ulrike Amitsandig and translator Karen Leder about Ulrike's novel, Monsters Like Us.
And welcome to this episode of Trafficker Europe's audio series, Women in Translation, showcasing the richness of European women authors and translators. Today, I'll be talking to German author and poet Ulrike Amitsandig about her book, Monsters Like Us, and her translator, Karen Leder. Hello, both.
Hello.
Hi, thank you so much for being with me today. To start us off, would you be able to tell our listeners a little bit about yourselves and your work? Maybe we can start with you, Ulrike.
Yeah, sure. I'm a writer and performance poet living in Berlin with my family and a dog. And Monsters Like Us is my first novel, but I think it's my second or third book.
Great, thank you. And what about you, Karen?
Sure, I'm an academic and translator, and I live and teach in Oxford, although at the moment I'm poet in residence at the Villa Valberta and the Lyrik Cabinet in Munich, so I'm talking to you from Munich. I guess those two aspects of my life, being an academic and a translator, are in a way quite different, but actually precisely in things like this they come together brilliantly, and it makes me very happy to be doing both.
Great, thank you so much. I'm looking forward to our conversation. To start off with, Ulrike, could you give us a summary of your book Monsters Like Us without giving away any spoilers, of course?
So Monsters Like Us is mostly a book about friendship and the power of mutual empathy. It's a friendship between two very different kids because they have a different background, Ruth and Victor. They are of the generation of the late 70s and grow up in a village in the eastern part of Germany and back then in the GDR. But it's also a novel about the monster that lives inside us and that is ready to develop some very unhealthy, toxic energy and turning to a violent monster, depending on the situation and the society we grow up in. But that is also a monster who could be a golem ready to save yourself and your beloved ones around you.
If you don't mind me asking, what was the inspiration behind writing this book?
I didn't really choose the topic or the story. It's more like I felt like there was a character, and that character in the beginning was Victor, that I got to know through actually a story that I wanted to write about a young man from the eastern part of Europe working as an au pair boy in southern France. And there was, within the story, it was not meant to be a novel, there was a certain point where I couldn't write on because I felt first, oh, this will be a story with a lot of violence in it and I'm not ready to write that down yet. And I started to be afraid of my own story. And secondly, I realized that I don't know this character well enough to actually know his actions, his reaction on what's actually happening around him. So I felt like I should have a look at his childhood and I should have a perspective that is not himself. And this is how I came to Ruth, who is about the same age as Victor is, but just another person. And she began to have a life very much of her own. But it wasn't the story or the topic or the theme in the beginning. It was really him, as if he was a living person, actually.
It's really interesting. And Karen, let's turn to you now. How did you come across the book and why did you decide that you wanted to translate it?
I've been translating Ulrike since 2011. I published a couple of books of translation of her poems. Dickicht came out as Thick of It in 2018. and I am a field of rapeseed, give cover to deer, and shine like 13 oil paintings laid one on top of the other, came out in 2020. And so I'd been wanting to do some of her prose for a while and had been thinking about short stories. But then when this novel arrived, it was clear to me that I did want to translate it. And I think that the sort of sense of the two children, the heart of it, and it seems to me they were absolutely compelling voices. But also, it's not only a coming-of-age story, but it's also a story about the fall of East Germany and life beyond it and the violence that unleashed. And as an academic, I'm interested in East Germany and have written a lot about it. And then finally, I thought that although it was a very brutal and violent story in lots of ways, the monsters that are within us, Ulrika said, it was also a beautifully tender and lyrical book, very poetic in a sense. And it was quite a challenge, really, not one that I was sure I could do, but quite a challenge to try and get those two aspects and see if I could bring them together.
Thank you so much for that introduction. Before we go on for a further discussion on the book, let's now hear a short excerpt of the book in German, read by Ulrika, and then we'll hear a longer excerpt in English, read by Karen.
The part that I'm about to read is told from the perspective of Ruth, Victor's best friend. The two kids are about 7 years old now, and they're already very close friends. In meiner unendlichen Kindheit geschahen alle Dinge gleichzeitig. Fly köpfte Fliegen und malträtierte das Cello. Ich tobte mit Victor und ließ mich von Großvater aussaugen. Wir lachten, weinten, verstanden nichts und aßen Eis. Wir verstanden alles und vergaßen es wieder. Unbemerkt von uns selbst verknüpften sich die Nervenzellen in unseren wachsenden Hirnen und wir lernten dazu. Unsere Eltern waren mit sich beschäftigt. Von allen Fenstern flackerten endlos die Tage, Sommer und Winter in einem. Victor und ich hopsten auf dem Sofa herum. Die Stube seiner Eltern war so leer wie das Esszimmer bei uns zu Hause, verfügte aber über einen Fernseher an der Schrankwand, der ausgeschaltet war und unsere Sprünge reflektierte. Das Sofa hatte einen samtig, kaminroten Bezug und Kissen mit Hirschmotiven darauf, die jetzt auf dem Boden verstreut lagen. Die Hirsche glotzten teilnahmslos zur Stubendecke hinauf. Victor hielt sich beim Hopsen am Fensterknauf fest und schaute hinaus zu den Telegrafenmasten auf den Feldern. Der Neubau, in dem er wohnte, gehörte zu den besten im Ort. Das Treppenhaus war frisch renoviert und hatte leuchtend rote Handläufe auf den Treppengeländern. In allen Wohnungen rauschte die Zentralheizung. Hinter dem Haus begannen die Felder. Im Winter standen dort Rehe im Nebel, im Sommer wucherte der Mais und versteckte sie. Auch wir hatten uns rufend und lachend im dunklen Grün der Stauden verlaufen und waren wieder aufgetaucht, die Arme voller Maiskolben. Die Unreifen waren weiß und süß, wir aßen sie sofort. Die Reifen nahmen wir hinauf in Victors Wohnung, entblätterten und brieten sie uns, bis sie goldgelb und salzig in unseren Händen lagen. So the second part that you are about to hear takes place some years later. Ruth and Victor are about 17 years old now. And while Ruth is not much around the area because she is very busy and practicing the violin, she has developed a musical talent for classical music. Victor has joined gang of young neo-Nazis and they are about to destroy a club, and this is where it all starts. Gegen 1 Uhr in der Nacht hielten die Autos vor dem Eisengatter, das zur Fabrikhalle an den Industriegleisen herunterführte. Es ist Zeit zu handeln, gröhlten Stuka aus den Boxen des Golfs, auf dessen Rücksitz, eingeklemmt zwischen zwei Kumpels seiner Statur, Victor saß. Deutschland muss und wird sich verwandeln. Im Kofferraum klirrten die Brandflaschen in den Bierkästen. Man hatte sich die Stunden mit Bastelarbeiten vertrieben. Zeit zum Einheizen, hatte Marcel irgendwann gesagt und die Baseballschläger aus seiner Privatsammlung verteilt. Und Victor hatte seinen in der Hand gewogen, beeindruckt vom Gewicht und der Maserung wie der auf alten Instrumenten. »Lass das krachen«, hatte das Mädchen mit dem ausrasierten Nacken am Steuer gesagt, als Victor mit den anderen aus dem Wagen stieg. »Aber bummelt nicht rum! Wenn die Bullen kommen, sind wir hier oben weg!« Victor spürte die Abgase der laufenden Motoren warm im Nacken, als er hinter Marcel und den anderen die schmale Treppe hinter dem Gatter ins Clubgelände hinunterstieg. Unten sah es unordentlich aus. In Büschen und Unkraut hingen Lichterketten, auf Mauerresten und herumliegenden Balken hockten die Zecken mit ihren wirren Frisuren. Dichter Rauch stieg aus ihren geöffneten Mündern. In der Ecke ein großes Lagerfeuer, wo sie sich drängten, lachten und einander weiß Gott was zwischen die Lippen schoben, wie Victor im Zwielicht zu erkennen meinte. Neben ihm standen zwei langhaarige Mädchen im Gebüsch und knutschten. Sie hielten ihre Augen geschlossen, als Victor und die anderen sich an ihnen vorbei zum Eingang schoben. Erst dort wurden die Baseballschläge aus den Jacken geholt. Der Einlasser, ein alter Bekannter von Marcel, konnte noch »Scheiß Nazis!« brüllen, da blutete ihm schon die Fresse. Während er auf der Seite lag, vorentwickelten Fähigkeit profitiert hatte, den Schalter umzulegen und rein gar nichts zu empfinden. Diesen nützlichen Schalter hatte Victor schon im Wagen des Mädchens umgelegt, so dass er jetzt lachend ausrufen konnte, »Hier sieht's ja aus wie im KZ!«
In my never-ending childhood, everything happened at once. Fly beheaded flies and mistreated his cello. I charged about with Victor and let myself be sucked dry by my grandfather. We laughed, wept, understood nothing and ate ice cream. We understood everything and forgot it again. Unnoticed by us, the neurons in our developing brains started making connections, and we learned more and more. Our parents were caught up with themselves. The endless days flickered by in front of the windows, summer and winter, blurred into one. Victor and I were bouncing on the sofa. His parents' living room was as empty as the dining room at home, but had a TV in the wall unit that was turned off and showed our reflections as we jumped. The sofa had a velvety crimson cover and cushions with deer on, but now lay scattered on the floor. The deer stared impassively up at the ceiling. Victor clung onto the handle of the window as he bounced and looked out at the telegraph poles in the fields. The new build where he lived was one of the best in the village. The stairwell had recently been renovated and had bright red handrails on the banisters. Central heating hummed in all apartments. Fields stretched away behind the house. In winter, deer peered out of the fog. In summer, the maize shot up and hid them. We too had gone shouting and laughing into the dark of the greenery and reappeared with armfuls of corn cobs. The unripe ones were white and sweet. We ate them immediately. The ripe ones we took up to Victor's apartment, stripped off the leaves, and boiled them until they sat golden yellow and salty in our hands. Now the pendant sun shone through the windows and disappeared in Victor's rough blonde hair. I jumped around him, giggling, but I could never jump as high as him. At a certain point, we couldn't carry on and collapsed on the sofa, me like a sack of flour, Victor like an athlete after an Olympic victory. I giggled and laughed because he punched his fist in the air like the Black Panthers on the winner's podium. Pap had told Fly and me about the black athletes in America and had reenacted their protest with us. Fly and I as Black Panthers at the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City. Me as Tommy Smith standing on the unmade bed, fist raised. Next to me, Fly as John Carlos. We each took one of Pap's black leather gloves and raised a child's fist in the air. Pap stood next to us as Peter Norman, stumbling his way through the American national anthem, which we bawled along with enthusiastically. In his theology studies, Pap had learned ancient Greek and Hebrew, and before that had suffered Russian lessons for years. but he couldn't speak English any more than his boisterous children. So he cobbled together the American anthem as he understood it. Odyssey, can you see by the dawn's leg alight what a bubble we held? Dead is egg softly teeming. We didn't understand a thing and sang our own version. The two people who were truly afraid had nonetheless protested at the way they and their people were treated, while we were still a twinkle in our father's eye. That he understood. I was laughing myself silly at Victor's raised fist when he suddenly reached out his index finger and pointed at the wall unit. You'll never believe what my brother-in-law does in there. In the cupboards? No, in the room behind. What is, I panted, still out of breath, a brother-in-law, anyway? The husband of my half-sister, Victor said. You won't believe what he does to me in there. I got up again to carry on bouncing, but I was curious and wanted to know. What does he do to you? He gets me naked. Why? I asked, barely listening. To bite me. I turned towards the wall unit and jumped into the air. It's just a bit of fun, Victor said. I'm supposed to lick his belly. The wall unit jumped up and down in front of my eyes, up and down. And I lick other parts of his body too, Victor said. The lamp also jumped. The door where someone could come in at any moment. The whole room jumped. And then I suck him, Victor said, until I get dizzy. He sat stubbornly on the sofa, his body bouncing up and down as I jumped. And my parents sit here and watch TV while I drink him dry, he said. Do you want to see how to do it? No, I said, and jumped as high as I could, as if there really was an Olympics to win. Nothing like that would ever happen to me, I decided. This is the second passage. It was almost 1 o'clock in the morning as the cars pulled up in front of the iron gate that led down to the factory hall on the industrial tracks. It's time to act, growled a Stuka song from the loudspeakers of the Golf, where Victor sat in the back seat, sandwiched between two mates of similar stature. Germany must change. Germany will change. In the boot, the petrol bombs clattered in the beer crates. Hours had been spent on handicrafts. Time to give him hell, Marcel had said at some point, and handed out the baseball bats from his private store. Victor had weighed his in his hand, impressed by the heft and the grain, like an old musical instrument. The girl with the shaved neck was at the wheel. Let's party, she said, as Victor got out of the car with the others. But don't hang about. When the cops come, us up here will be off. Victor felt the exhaust fumes from the running engines warm on the back of his neck as he went down the narrow staircase behind the gate into the club grounds, following Marcel and the others. Downstairs it looked a mess. Fairy lights were strung through the trees and scrubby bushes. There was scum everywhere, perching on the crumbling walls and old beams with their tangled hairstyles, dense smoke rings rising from their open mouths. In the corner was a large bonfire, where they crowded round laughing and shoving who knows what down their throats, as Victor saw in the dim light. Not far away, two girls with long hair stood in the bushes snogging. They kept their eyes closed as Victor and the others pushed past them to the entrance. That's when the baseball bats came out of the jackets. The doorman, an old acquaintance of Marcel's, just had time to shout, "Fucking Nazis!" before blood spurted from his face. As he lay on his side, cowering under Marcel's attack, Victor clambered over him. Inside, the ceiling was hung with military netting containing countless shoes. They reminded him of a school visit to Buchenwald, where he had used his ability developed years earlier to flip an inner switch and feel nothing at all. Victor had already flipped this useful switch in the girl's car, so that he could now shout with glee, It looks like a concentration camp in here. They smashed up the club. They swept the bottles from the bar, sending splinters of glass flying into the air. They jumped over the bar and trampled the decadent cocktail mixers, crushed the test tubes for the Bloody Marys, and poured the contents of the cash register into the outdoor toilet at the back exit. It wasn't about the money. It wasn't about the principle either. But in the backs curled before him, the arms raised in self-defense, and the centrifugal power of the baseball bat in Victor's hand, lay something that came pretty close to his idea of joy. Until he saw the dance floor. Despite the almost complete darkness, he recognized Ruth immediately. She stood on the edge, swaying lightly, lost in the rhythmic beat that still emanated from the loudspeakers, even though the DJ had long since scarpered. It was some kind of cover version of this old malaria song, cold, clear water, coming towards him from the speakers, while Ruth's slender figure leant forwards and moved slightly to the monotonous beat, as if nothing else in the world existed. She had shorter hair now, that fell to one side as she danced, revealing her eyes. Victor paused and walked closer. Strobe lights lit up the dance floor in jerky flashes, so that Ruth looked different with each beat, a flipbook with pages missing. "Over my hands," a woman's voice sang. Ruth's fingernails still looked just as bitten as they had when they used to bake salt dough together in a previous life. "Over my arms, over my shoulders." Her ears are fine, and yet she doesn't even get that the rooms in front are being taken apart. "Over my legs, over my thighs." He looked at Ruth like he had never looked at her before, not during their rare meetings in the school playground, and not years before, when he didn't have a friend like Marcel, and she had the most beautiful mother in the world. For the first time, he looked at her like a stranger looking at a stranger, as if each of her movements were directed towards him. Beneath her plaid shirt were amazing breasts that swayed softly to the beat. "Over my breast, I close my eyes." When he finally stood behind the abandoned DJ's booth and ripped the plug out, Ruth stopped abruptly and looked round. Except for them, there was no one left in the room. With the speakers silent, the crashing and groaning from the other rooms was suddenly deafening. In the chill-out zone, there was a noise like New Year's Eve fireworks. From the VIP room came bright ceiling lights and curses because Marcel was in there, slitting open the mattresses in search of the good stuff. From somewhere came the sound of glass shattering. Arms hanging by her sides, Ruth stood on the edge of the empty dance floor and stared at Victor in surprise. What he wanted to do was hide her in his bomber jacket. "Piss off, man! Make yourself scarce," he shouted at her. But she didn't piss off. Slowly she crossed the dance floor. The strobe light was still on. Jerkily, she went up behind the DJ's desk and stood in front of Victor. She reached up to his shoulder. Her breasts were only a hair's breadth away from him. "So now," she said calmly, "you are one of them too."
Thank you so much for those readings. As we heard, Ulrika, you write from multiple characters' perspectives in this book. Could you tell us a little bit more about why you chose this structure?
On the one hand, I think I love following my characters' decisions and I love learning how they think and why they think the way they do. That could be one explanation. The other one probably could be that when you think about certain topics like violence, salvation from a toxic circle of violence, about topics like when does empathy can be developed and what surrounding would you need to have to even notice that someone wants to be your friend. And when you think about certain topics, it helps to think about them from different perspectives. So I guess I need to encircle my own question from different angles to come closer to what I actually want to find out. So if you want to, it's actually a sort of questioning, or not questioning, but it's a research with the means of language and literature to find out certain stuff. And for that, I need different perspectives, because if I just told the story from, say, Victor's perspective, I wouldn't have been able to truly understand his level of actual empathy.
Karen, how was that to translate a book that is written in multiple voices? Did you find that a challenge?
The real challenge, in a way, was shifting from poems to prose. I have done prose before, but I've never done anything quite as intense or as long as this. But actually, in a way, that's slightly akin to poetry, because each voice is different, and so you have to find each different voice. So you find Ruth and you find Victor. And then actually it's a little bit easier than poetry, because with poetry, the poem's over before you know it, just when you found the voice. But actually here you have the whole section, and so every day you just tune back into that sound. But then, of course, you have to start again with a new character. So I think in terms of the different characters, I didn't really find it a challenge. I suppose one of the big challenges about these characters is that they're children. And as you heard in the extracts, actually sometimes you go into their, as it were, into their view. There's a sort of stil indirect libre, as they say. You're partaking of their thoughts and their language. And it was a question of maintaining that, maintaining for the children the sense of knowing and not knowing, never being too obvious, never being too unambiguous, never being too clear, but also then finding the particular language. So, for example, for Victor, when he's a part of a neo-Nazi gang, I had to go to some very unsavoury websites to find out what kind of language in English would be right. So, yes, it was about really just investing in those different voices and all their different quirks.
On that subject of poetry, Ulrika, you started out as a poet, correct me if I'm wrong. Why did you decide to make that move from writing poetry to writing prose for this particular text?
Oh, I didn't really make that move because I've always been writing poetry and prose. It's just that my first two books that I published were poetry collections. And then quite quickly, and very much of a surprise for myself, I got some awards in poetry. So I ended up being seen as a poet, which of course I am, but I do write prose, and I've always done that, but I guess it just took me a little bit longer. And for example, this story or this novel is a work that I started, the earliest parts of it, I started to write them around 2016, but I had the story in mind way before. So there, I always need really some years to carry a character in my heart, to think about this character, to think about why I actually have this. Is this just something that I could also write a radio play or a piece of music or poetry about? Or is this really a prose? So there is a process that needs time to get me to write prose.
How does your poetry inform your prose? Do you find that they're related?
To me, it's actually the same process. When I start, or when I'm in the midst of writing something, I actually use the same techniques. For instance, for this novel, I didn't make a lot of notes or even storylines or anything like that. I developed most of the story in my head, like chapter per chapter, as I would do in poetry, because I needed to know the sound of it, and the sound as something that helps me, and not to get the musicality or the tone of it, but also that helps me to understand my own story. So I developed it in my head, and then when I'm already pretty sure about what the next chapter is actually about and about its details, even then I start to write it down. And this is actually also how I write poetry. So there, to me, from the working perspective, there's not much of a difference. But of course, in the end, it sounds and reads different, but that's more on the side of the reader than of the side of me as the author.
And Karen, you mentioned at the beginning of our interview that you found the original German very poetic in nature. How did you try to capture that in your translation?
Yes, I think you're right. That was one of the very impressive things about the text. And there are a lot of texts about violence and brutality, but very few are written in such a musical, poetic register. And it's partly the way those two things interact that make it so compelling, I think, actually. I think it goes back to what I said before, that one of the themes of the book is about knowing and not knowing, or about ambiguity. And in fact, even at one point, one of the characters says, "I know what you're thinking now, just be clear and unambiguous," but nothing was clear. And I think that was the key to writing, the sense that it always had to be on a knife edge. Simple language from the children, poetic language very often in the descriptions, never too heavy, never too precise, never too unambiguous. There's a kind of incredible lightness about it. And even actually in one chapter, there is a kind of scene in which violence is taking place, but we don't really know. What we hear is a freight train thundering through the night and the barrier going up, cling, cling, and then the train noises. And it's never been too heavy. It's always just sort of sitting in the language and letting it flow above the action almost. I hope that's not an injustice, Obika, but that's how it felt to me sometimes. And of course, music is very important in the text as well. Music is a really big theme too.
And as you said, that contrasts with some of the very heavy themes that we see in the book, one of which, as we heard in the extract, is sexual abuse that both Ruth and Victor experience. Ulrika, could you expand a little bit on this? And maybe could you tell us a bit about the use of the vampire imagery that we heard in the extracts?
When I was writing, I think, the childhood part of the novel, I found it pretty difficult to let the reader know that there is actually sexual abuse that's happening, and there is two very different forms of sexual abuse happening, because I didn't want to outwardly write every little detail of it, because this would be even too hard for myself to bear. So I imagine, so this is just not readable for my readers as well. So I was looking in literature and its history for ways how to describe violence, and specifically sexual violence. And what I found was the long history of vampire stories going back to Bram Stoker. I was intrigued by the pretty outwardly written scene that just didn't need the word sex, or that didn't need the word penetration, to make sure that there is actually happening a lot in Bram Stoker's Dracula scenes. So for some certain time, I thought, okay, I should not even mention that there is sexual abuse. I should just write it as a vampire novel. But this also, of course, didn't work out, because there's different perspectives in this novel. And one perspective is Ruth as a grown-up person remembering, and of course she does remember what she has experienced. And so eventually I decided to give this vampire imagery, to give that as a gift, or as something, as a support, as a language support to the kids, because they are too young to really know the words, or to really speak out what's happening to them, especially Ruth, who is, despite being seemingly smarter in a way, she doesn't really know how to express her feelings. And what the kids do is they don't share their real stories. They don't really know what's happening to the other, except for this one scene that we were just listening to, that we were just reading for you, the sofa scene, the jumping on the sofa when Victor tells Ruth what his brother-in-law actually does to him. But that is about the only scene where he does that, where he does tell what's happening. And apart from that, the kids only share stories about vampires. So when the child Ruth, from her perspective, when she says granddad sucks on me, she's actually telling that he's abusing her without telling that.
Let's move on to a conversation on the translation of this book. Karen, you work as a scholar in German studies, as you mentioned. Do you think it's important to have a prior knowledge of the culture and a deep understanding of the culture in order to be a translator?
That's actually a big question and quite a controversial one, as you probably know. I think a lot of people do translate from languages they don't know and cultures that they don't know about. And I've no doubt that many of them do very good jobs. I don't translate from languages I don't know. And I think it's helped me enormously that I do have a background in German studies and German literature. And actually, in this case, I've written a lot about East Germany, and that was helpful in terms of the specifics of language. For example, there are lots of terms that go back to a very local language that existed in the GDR and wasn't the same in the West, but also hints. For example, in one scene, the kids go up into the attic and there's just a half line about all the antennae in the roof pointing west. And if you know the culture, that says a huge amount, because it means that they're listening illegally to West German radio or watching West German TV illegally. And a lot of nuances like that, I think, which say an awful lot about a political standpoint or a social aspect. And so that was very helpful. But in a way, of course, there is Google now. None of these things are out of reach. And in the same way, I'm not a believer in kind of method translation. You don't have to only translate what you exactly know. And the reason I said it's controversial at the moment is, of course, because it's a big debate about actors at the moment, whether they can only act for their own race and nationality, or translators, indeed. The translation of the American poet Amanda Gorman was very controversial when it turned out that the translation into Dutch, I think, actually, wasn't going to be done by somebody who was black. I think it's a kind of minefield, but for me, then, that is an enormous sort of first step in understanding all the nuances of a text. But equally, it's rather fun to extend one's range. And I've also translated things that I know much less about and really enjoyed getting to understand all the details as I go.
And as you mentioned, you translated some of Ulrika's work before. So I assume that you already have a good relationship, and that's a good contact for you as well to ask any questions. Did you collaborate at all on the translation?
Yes, we did. I think that's one of the really fun things about working with a contemporary author, if you can collaborate with them. And Ulrika was fantastically generous and helpful when I did have questions. There were specific things where I wanted to tease out what was the key thing going on here for her. But particularly, there's a general thing that Ulrika and I have in her poetry too, where because German is a much smaller language than English, very often words can have several meanings in English. And a very common conversation between us is, I say, I see that this word has a number of meanings. Which is the most important to you? And she says, all of them. So it's that conversation happens in various formats very often. But I think understanding the kind of nuance behind what an author is saying is very helpful in having to make those hard decisions where the multiple choice is available.
Do you have any specific examples from when you're translating this text? Any linguistic or cultural difficulties that you came across?
Sure. There's a linguistic one, actually, which came up in that passage about the right-wing thugs beating up the people in the club, which is the word zeck or zecker, which means tick in German, and is a kind of a slang word for the foreign people that they despise. And it covers all kinds of people. And I've never really got to the bottom of what is the equivalent in English, actually. I'm not sure we have quite an equivalent. We don't move in the animal realm, certainly. And I ended up translating it as scum. I think we do talk about it in a very derogatory way. So that one I was really testing out. When they use that of someone, what is the chief thing they're getting at in the insult, for example? So that's an example of a kind of word that just, where you have to just try and find something else. But also, I think culturally, even though I knew the background very well, there were things where it was so helpful to have input from Ulrika. There's one part in which Victor travels on a long train journey to go to France to be an au pair. And the train journey is quite long and quite an interesting in itself. And one of the things we see is the rest of the compartment who are travelling with him. And a huge nuances in the descriptions of the other people, which are a snapshot of the post-1989, sort of early 1990s situation in Germany. And one which actually bewildered me at the beginning. So, for example, there are two girls who keep talking about going to be waitresses, and it became clear talking to Ulrika, but I have to say it wasn't quite clear to me at the beginning that actually, of course, they were going to go and be sex workers. But it was part of that cultural context of the desperation and the lack of money. And in the same compartment, there's a surgeon going to do building work. And I thought, why is he going to do building work? Is he going to build himself a holiday home, or what's he doing? And she said, no, in those days, things were so bad that even professionals sometimes could earn more doing a season's manual work than they could in their own job. And so there's a huge amount there about a very particular cultural context, which is done very deftly, I think, and which it was enormously helpful to kind of just tease out with Ulrika and try and find a way of bringing that out in the English.
And Ulrika, what was your perspective on the translation process?
When Karen started to translate Monsters Like Us, she had already translated so much poetry that I had written, and our collaboration or sharing of my text was already going on for so many years that I was amazed by her understanding of the overall story and of the tone. So I thought, okay, there will be lots of questions and perhaps lots of misunderstandings because it's a lot of text and there are so many fine-tuned dialects, as you already told you about, and hints to the 90s. And there's a very local tone about it and some stuff that are not even known by Germans who are about my age because they're West German. So it's a very East German novel in a sense. And Karen already had known my literature so well that I was really amazed by the fact that there was not that much questions that I had expected. And when I finally got her translation, I must say I didn't read all of it because it feels strange to read your own book again because it's so intense to me, really. It makes me emotional. So I chose some parts that were very dear to me and read them again. I was stunned by how much it feels my own.
And I wanted to ask you as well, because as I understand it, you were born in East Germany.
Yes.
What was it like to revisit that time when you were writing this book?
Oh, it was interesting. It was like time capsule carrying me back. Sometimes I fell in kind of a loophole and had to revisit scenes that I would have rather forgotten. But especially the scenery of the villages and small towns, the countryside I grew up in was extremely interesting to do my research in and to remember that. And by writing that book, I found out that the countryside where I grew up had changed so much since I was a kid, of course. And it's such a long time ago, but sometimes you just don't realize and you think back and you think, oh, this is where I'm from, but you don't really realize that it has so much changed since then. And it was also interesting to have a close look at the right-wing scene of my generation, at the neo-Nazi scene, because I wasn't part of that when I was young. I was more part of the punk scene and the gothic scene a bit. I guess I was mostly seen as an emo, just that we didn't have that word emo yet back then. But I remembered some people, especially one friend who I knew from childhood, and I knew that he had joined a Nazi gang when he was a teenager. So I reached out to him. He lives in Munich or near Munich by now, and I found him and we talked a lot about how he has experienced these years and what kind of language he had, what kind of music he had listened to. And that was a very close look to something that had been so close to my own upbringing, but being so different. And that was extremely interesting, yeah.
Maybe I could just pick up something that I heard from the last answer. It's my impression that the novel is primarily received as being about sexual abuse. And it would be such a shame if people didn't realise that actually it's about so much more as well. It's a coming-of-age story. It's a story about art. Ruth escapes into her music, for example. Art is a kind of redemption, but also it allows her to change emotionally. It's an elegy for a lost country, a country and a countryside that doesn't exist anymore. And at the end, there's a very powerful image of the diggers, the mining, these huge diggers, creating a kind of moonscape of the villages and the small towns that were there. But it's also a novel about power and violence, not only in the very specific form of sexual abuse, but about the kind of small violences that go on in every layer of society and even in every family and between people that kind of corrode ways of being. And so it seems to me it's not a GDR book. It's not a single book about a single idea, sexual abuse. It's a very fine and nuanced text. And I really hope people get beyond the sort of central thing, which I know everybody is talking about, which is the question of sexual abuse, to appreciate all these other things that are woven in.
Would you like to add anything to that, Ulrika?
Yeah, I absolutely agree to Karen. And I just also want to add that when you look at the cover of the book, a girl that could be Ruth looking at you, and in front of her is something that looks like a drawing, but it's actually the map of the moon. And this moon is an image that carried me through the writing process, because I had a piece of music in my mind and very often frequently listened to it when I wrote it, and that is the Moonlight Sonata by Beethoven. So the symphony, precisely the symphony in cis minor. And eventually I took the structure of this musical piece in three parts and looked at it, or it helped me to structure actually the novel. So to me, the novel is also a sort of musical piece in the sense that it works with musical patterns taken from Beethoven, which it's not really mentioned in the book, but there's always the question, how do you structure your own story? But as I was listening to Beethoven through the whole time when I was writing it, there are a lot of moons and there is darkness, but the light and darkness mostly. And this is also why I think Karen is quite right saying that there is this certain kind of musicality in it. So music as a form of escape for Ruth, but eventually music becomes a refuge and even a way out of her own history, of her own destiny as a victim. So music as something that makes you powerful and makes you explore the world.
That's so interesting. I'd love to keep talking to you. It's been a really interesting conversation, but unfortunately we've reached the end of our time. Just before we say goodbye, are you working on any upcoming projects or any new books or translations coming out that we should look out for?
Oh, I'm going to go straight in there and plug one, which is that I finished the manuscript of Ulrika's next poetry volume, which came out this year in German, called Leuchtende Schafe, and it'll be Shining Sheep in English. And I'm very hopeful, and in fact, I believe it's been taken up by Seagull already. And so I'm really hoping that will come out in 2023 or thereabouts. Very exciting.
Great, looking forward to it. What about you, Ulrika?
I'm currently translating poetry from New Zealand, actually. It's a volume that is written by Hinemwana Baker, a Hov Pakeha, Hov Maori, queer performance poet from Christchurch in New Zealand. And that's very interesting to me to be a translator myself this time. And as soon as I have finished the manuscript, I want to really start writing prose again. I have two characters in my mind that I've been thinking about for a while now. The only thing I can say is probably that it's a story about love in the times of war, about the safety of your own body, especially as a woman. And it's about drug abuse, chemical drug abuse. But I really need to write that story now, I guess.
That's really exciting. Thank you so much both for talking to me today. It's been a really interesting conversation.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
This has been German author Ulrika Amitsandik and translator Karen Leder, focusing on the novel Monsters Like Us, just out in English translation from Seagull Books.
Women in Translation is an audio series showcasing the richness of European women authors, translators, and more. This series is executive produced by Trafica Europe Radio. Please sign up at our website to stay informed about upcoming shows. Thanks for listening.